Hello and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, here with Victor Davis Hansen, the Morton and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, turning today to a recent piece that you wrote for Defining Ideas entitled 10 Paradoxes for Our Age. We won't have time to get through all of them here, but I just want to examine a few of them with you. And I want to start with an argument that you address in this piece. It was very fashionable a decade or two ago, and now is really starting to show its age. People used to say that you could be long-term optimistic about a country like China because the fact that they started opening up their economy, that they abandoned that part of the communist playbook, would inevitably let the camel's nose under the tent. And then as day follows night, we would see economic freedom giving rise to political freedom. And yet we now see Xi Jinping with more power than ever, and this powerful and fundamentally sort of illiberal state that doesn't show any signs at the moment anyway of weakening. What did that sort of economically deterministic argument get wrong?
Well, they got wrong that everybody having a cell phone or a laptop or clean water would mean that in their leisure time or their happiness or their contentment with these impertinences, then they would, you know, as if they were John Locke or Socrates, they would think about political freedom next because they didn't have to worry about eating and sleeping all the time. And only poor people were going to be ruined by autocratic governments. But whether it's the left or right, it really hasn't worked because what we've seen is that leaders such as the Chinese take credit for it. They say, we only got this liberalization economically because of our political authoritarianism. And we see it on the left and the right. I mean, the Bush administration pretty much and the Clinton administration sold us on the idea that we had to run up deficits with China because then we were bringing them into the new world order, so to speak. And then they would, you know, the Tiananmen Squares would be happening every day. And then the Obama administration basically said Turkey was their special partner. Remember that window on the West, and Erdogan was a good guy. And he was bringing 20 million people into the Istanbul corridor. It was sort of going to be like Silicon Valley. And then they just kind of dropped all that when he turned out to be a neo-Ottoman Islamicist. So I don't know of any historical evidence that suggests the more economic prosperity that you achieve, the more liberal you're going to be. I know Thomas Friedman never thought that. To give one example, a lot of liberal people flew into China and they went on high-speed rail. They looked at the airports. They said, man, this stuff is because they don't have a House and Senate. They've got a philosopher king that can just snap his fingers and get solar panels, where we have all these right-wing people that are obstructionists. They don't believe in global warming. But the Chinese, because they have an authoritarian, enlightened, economic dynamic machine, can do the things that we want. And it's even true in our own country. You know, if you talk to the left and look at the Obama EPA or the Obama Pentagon or the Obama IRS, the idea was, these are better than the Congress or the courts, because they can, because you can enact change non-democratically by fiat. The EPA can kind of make its own laws and enforce them. So can the IRS. And they like that efficiency. And yet, so I just don't think that there's much of a correlation between economic prosperity and constitutional government.
While we're on foreign affairs, there's another interesting observation in this piece. You have a line here which would have been baffling for foreign policy types up until about 5 minutes ago, which is the Middle East is not the center of the geostrategic universe. And Victor, so much of our foreign policy energy, especially for the last few decades since the end of the Cold War, has been dedicated to the Middle East. But now it does seem, sort of Iran aside, as if it's taking on decidedly secondary status. What happened to get us here?
Oh, there were two or three things that happened. The most important was that the United States this year becomes the largest energy producer in all three key categories. That is natural gas, coal, and believe it or not, oil. And the Middle East, and that second And the corollary to that was Israel is now completely self-sufficient in natural gas and oil. The second major thing is that the Gulf monarchies and the so-called moderate, I don't know if they're moderate or not, but that's what we call them, Egypt and Jordan, realize that Persian Shia hegemony is a much more dangerous threat, existential threat, than is Israel. And so we have this Orwellian situation that Israel with 180 nukes is a de facto ally of Saudi Arabia against the threat of just one nuke in the possession of Iran someday. And so that's really changed. And then third, you know, this has been 75 years since the Palestinians say that they left the West Bank with the keys of their homes in Jerusalem and they're refugees. And I ask, and I think the world's saying to themselves, well, how about the million Jews that left between, you know, 45 and the 70 Yom Kippur War from Syria, Iraq, Egypt, that were ethnically cleansed from the Arab world? And how about the 13 million Sudetenland Germans, East Prussians, that walked back to Germany after World War II at exactly the same time as the Palestinians? And you can see where I'm going. There's refugees all over the world of that generation, but only the Palestinians have the moral virtue. And I think people just got tired of it, and they don't want to give them $750 million a year. And more importantly, when we got tired of it, we were supposed to be told the world's coming to an end. And Trump said, I'm going to bomb the SHIT out of ISIS. And he did. And there's basically no more ISIS. And that really sent a message that if you have the will to do things that you're supposedly not supposed to do, you can stop it. And same thing with his travel ban, the Supreme Court just. So I think there was a combination that Israel is more powerful than ever. It's self-sufficient. We don't need the oil for ourselves. Everybody's more worried about Iran. And people are just exhausted by Palestinian victimhood. Put it all together and you know, the real issues in the world are China and our relationship with Russia and what to do about North Korea, things like that.
One final point on the international affairs front, also from this piece. In Europe, you note that Germany has long been a source of anxiety for its neighbors. And in the past, of course, that's largely been rooted in German expansionism and militarism. But these days, Germany is still being watched with a wary eye in the region, but over a very different set of issues. Explain the concern that it's engendering these days.
Well, Germany is almost Prussian again in its attitude. It's almost postmodern Prussian. So they acted a particular way after unification in 1871 and 1914, 1939. And we all said that that was due to German unification and nationalism and ethnocentrism, triumphalism, whatever we use the word. But it might have been just German culture, because if you look at that, the way that Germany is treating Eastern Europe on matters of immigration, basically, you're going to have open borders like we do, and you're going to take this many people or else. And they're saying no. And they're splitting the EU East and West. And then Germany's basically saying to Italy and Portugal and Spain and Greece, well, you know, for 20 years, we had kind of a mercantile system. We sold you Volkswagens and BMWs and Siemens electrical goods. And we knew you really couldn't pay for them. So we gave you easy credit, and you made the interest payments. It was kind of a great little system. And then lo and behold, we found out you couldn't pay for them. I wonder how that happened. But now we want all of our money back, and we're going to make you have certain Germanic rules of economic practice to make sure you pay us back. And that split the EU, not just East and West, but North and South. And then Britain came along and said, you know what? We are a democratic system, and were some of our democratic parts, and we just kind of want to pass. We believe in referenda. We had one referendum. We had one, and we'll see you. And Germany kind of said, okay, you want to get out of the EU? Well, this is what we're going to do to you in a punitive fashion to pay you back for that. And then there was this fourth relationship with the United States, and it was basically, okay, we're going to tax your cars at 10%, but you're going to tax ours at 2.5%. And we're going to run up a $69 billion trade deficit, but we don't have any money to spend on defense. We can only have 5 aircraft and 100 tanks that actually work. And we're not going to spend our promised 2% on NATO of GDP expenditures. But you know what? You don't dare mention that, and you are committed to NATO leadership, and you're going to spend 4% GDP, and you're going to come over here and protect us. And so Trump, you know, sort of just came in, and everybody said that was normal, and he was an outsider and said, you know, I don't think that's normal. I don't think friends run up $69 billion mercantile surpluses. I don't think they welch on their promises to share the defense burden. I don't think they expect us 75 years after World War II to have 35,000 Americans in Germany. And that got everybody outraged. But they never really refuted his main premises. They never said to Merkel, why are you doing this? So I guess what I'm saying is that Germany has sort of cut the EU off from the United States, from Britain, from Eastern Europe, and from Southern Europe. And it's done it in the same fashion that it always does. It's my way or the highway. My way or the Autobahn, I guess I should say.
Let me turn you another observation in this piece. This one, this is about the current state of Western civilization. And you say in here that the most immediate threats to that project are not sort of the conventional ones born of hardship that one thinks of with civilizations that are in turmoil. It's not hunger. It's not global warming. It's not inequality or religious fundamentalism. They're more, as you describe them, problems of affluence, or I guess we could say decadence. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I think what's very hard is that these early constitutional republics, ours included, were born out of a desire of community and hard work and values. And we all know what those are. You postpone conspicuous consumption, you save more than you spend, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But once you, that's, I think Daniel Bell called it the cultural contradictions of capitalism. Once you do that, you start to get wealthier. And then as you start to get wealthier, it's very hard to pass those values on to a second, third, and fourth generation that knows of the consumption, but not the mechanisms to ensure the consumption. So we have this ridiculous situation where we have these 25-year-old kids living in their parents' basements while we have 11 million people coming up from Mexico supposedly to mow their lawn. And I just went to a specialist the other day in Fresno, and I'd say that 70% of the patients in the office were Medi-Cal patients, that is very impoverished people from southern Mexico, most of them illegal, none of them who spoke English. But I can tell you that all of the health-related issues that were plaguing them were not starvation, or they were not the lack of adequate health care, or the not the lack of adequate diet. It was obesity, obesity, obesity. And I can also tell you that everybody there had a cell phone and was using it, you know, texting or whatever while they're waiting for the doctor. And yet when I turn on the television, I get a different reality that poor people are starving in the United States. No, they're not. We have an epidemic, but it's called type 2 onset diabetes that affects one of every three people admitted to a California hospital. Too much food, too little exercise, and it's just the opposite of what we've been told. And that's true of the West in general. In Europe, the same thing. And psychologically, it means that you don't want to judge anybody because you feel that you've transcended the physical barriers of human existence long ago. You know where you're going to sleep at night. You know that somebody's going to break into your village and kill everybody that night. You know your food's not going to make you sick. The water's not polluted. And then you have supposedly time to be philosophical without those existential parameters around you, or kind of not, you're no longer in a corral of need. And the result is when you're freed of that, humans are not always very adept at using their freedom and leisure and affluence. And that's what we see today. And with Hollywood or the entertainment or the media, and it becomes almost a psychodrama where everybody's parading around as if they're a victim when they're not at all. They're the most blessed generation in the history of the planet.
The final thing that I'll ask you about, you have an observation in this piece about the threats to constitutional government, in which you're basically arguing that the kind of stereotypical, almost kind of Hollywood-driven ideas about this are incorrect. And you write in this piece, those responsible for eroding our freedoms will not likely be jowled generals in shades and epaulets, but the lean and cool in hip suits who speak mellifluously of a predetermined arc of history bending toward their utopian mandate. Now, some of our keener listeners may know what that suggests, but tease that out for us.
Yeah, I managed not to use the word Obama. That was hard. But I mean, Obama said he was a constitutional law professor, and he was mellifluous. But he used that mellifluousness and that his legal fides to create a facade where they said he wouldn't dare do that. He's a progressive, without any knowledge that usually progressives are the ones from Woodrow Wilson on that kind of destroyed personal liberty whenever they had the chance. I mean, the people who put Japanese citizens into internment camps were Earl Warren, the McClatchy newspapers, and FDR. So under Obama, we had James Rosen's emails tapped. We had the Associated Press press monitored. We had the IRS weaponized Lois Lerner's vindictive campaign against political opponents. We had the FBI putting informants into an oppositional political campaign. We had the National Security Council weaponized in the sense that they used confidential transcripts, unmasked the names, leaked them to the press. We had the FISA courts warped by the Steele dossier, in which the judges were not apprised by people like Rod Rosenstein and James Comey that the file was non-verified, a product of opposition research, and in circular fashion used to create news stories to support its authenticity. And that all came from a law professor. And so we do pretty well with Donald Trump because the media despises him and watches every little thing he does, from the diet to the types of drinks that he consumes to the way he combs his hair 24/7, always looking for some angle to say that he's Hitler or Stalin, some type of dictator. And he's not going to be able to challenge the Constitution. When he has a travel ban, then he does it again, his legal expert, and then a judge turns it down. And finally, he does it not on the basis of religion, but he has, you know, Venezuela's in it, and North Korea's in it, Iran's in it. Just, it's unstable places. And he follows the law, but Obama did not. And we didn't say anything because he seemed to be part of the establishment. He was young, he was cool, he was smooth. But most importantly, the ends that he sought for all of us, egalitarianism, equality, fairness, we felt are so noble that they could justify almost any means necessary to obtain them. And so it was kind of a French Revolution light. And that's what's scary about the left, because we can just sort of sleepwalk into tyranny because they're all doing it, whether it's Mao or whether it was Maduro in Venezuela or Castro. They all do it for us. We're a right-wing thug that wants to do it, human nature being, you know, pretty bad. He doesn't have any very good optics. He's selfish. He's got a bunch of cronies. We all can see what he's up to, but not the people with the smooth rhetoric and the messaging and the agendas that they're suffering. And we have to do all this stuff for the common person and for the poor and for the needy.
All right. Again, you can read the piece that was the basis for this conversation. It's called 10 Paradoxes for Our Age at definingideas@hoover.org. Thanks for tuning into the Classicist podcast. And if you enjoy the show, please give us a rating on iTunes. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.